Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Heather Boushey, the Executive Director and Chief Economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, and speak about the social impact of the failure to extend unemployment benefits in the budget deal that on December the 28th will cut loose 1.3 million Americans into poverty. We will also look into the political future of the budget deal that is being attacked by lawmakers on both the left and the right as Congress prepares to shut down for the holidays. Then we'll be joined by Henry Giroux, a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University, and the author of Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism, and America's Educational Deficit and the War on Youth, Reform Beyond Electoral Politics. We will discuss his recent appearance on Bill Moyers, where he discussed zombie politics and the challenges of mobilizing the indentured generation of students into political activism so that they can take back their future. Then finally, with the suspension of aid to the Syrian rebels by the US and the UK following the seizure of Free Syrian Army bases and warehouses full of weapons by Islamists, we will speak with Middle East expert Asher Kaufman. He is a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame and was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace. And we will discuss the latest rebel infighting and recent predictions that this war could go on for a decade. And joining us now is Heather Boushey, who is the Executive Director and Chief Economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth and a Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. Her research focuses on economic inequality and public policy, specifically employment, social policy, and family economic well-being, and she testifies before Congress often on economic policy issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Heather Boushey.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And of course, Heather, the lawmakers on both the left and the right in the Congress are not happy with the budget deal that has just been made, and they are also preparing to leave and shut the Congress down for the holidays. So what is the likelihood in terms of the cutting out the unemployment benefits from this budget deal, meaning that on December the 28th, 1.3 million Americans will be cut loose and face poverty?
Well, it looks as if that is not going to be a part of this deal. I mean, certainly the deal that came down today does not have extending benefits for the long-term unemployed as a part of the package. And it looks like the House and the Senate are going to go home without actually making that happen. Now, certainly there's a lot of folks that are upset about it. I've heard a lot of rumblings about different strategies to at least get the Senate to vote on or to have discussions around extending unemployment insurance benefits, but that's not likely to go through the House right now. I will note that there have been times in the in recent years where Congress has failed to vote to extend long-term unemployment benefits before they expire, but then they have retroactively extended those benefits at a later date. So I don't want to leave the listeners with a sense that this is totally over, but certainly where we stand today, extending benefits to the long-term unemployed is not a part of the package that that is coming down the pipeline.
And how much of a revolt on the right was there against Congressman Paul Ryan, who brokered the deal with Senator Patty Murray? There were rumblings from the Tea Party right in the House that he was something of a traitor.
That he was not taking it far enough, in their view. I mean, certainly this Congress and the Republicans have had a really challenging, the Republican leadership has had a challenging job in front of them. They've got one part of their caucus that is, quite frankly, quite extremist and does not think that negotiation is the way that democratic politics should work. And so certainly people were frustrated, when Congressman Ryan and Senator Murray started the budget negotiations. They took entitlements off the table, meaning that they decided, you know what, we're not going to talk about the long-term challenges. We're not going to talk about doing anything around Social Security or Medicare. And, you know, there are a lot of folks that really wanted to see some more sort of big cuts over the long term. But those just, they weren't a part of the package because they wanted to get to a deal so that we could avert yet another government shutdown.
But what we're talking about here is $26 billion in terms of the cut in unemployment benefits, which in the overall scheme of things, given the size of the federal budget, is an absolute drop in the bucket. So what is it then about people like Senator Rand Paul, who on Fox on Sunday, quoting him, said, when you allow people to be on unemployment insurance for 99 weeks, you're causing them to become part of the perpetual unemployment group in our economy? Well, number one, he got the numbers wrong. It's actually the maximum is 73 weeks. But I don't understand the logic of saying that you're allowing people somehow to become perpetually unemployed. And in order to help them, you actually have to punish them by taking away their benefits.
It is a very convoluted argument that Rand Paul has put out there. I mean, you know, this is the thing. First of all, 5 years into after the depths of the Great Recession, we still have a share of Americans at work today that is just a few tenths of a percentage point higher than it was in the deepest, darkest days of the Great Recession. Yes, we have created jobs each month. And yes, it's fantastic that we created over 200,000 jobs last month. And yes, the unemployment rate has come down from double digits down to 7%. That's all terrific. But that has been, those gains have basically just sopped up all the new entrants into the U.S. labor market. And basically what we have today is a situation where the share of people at work remains about the same. We've not seen an increase in the actual share of people who have a job because of the increase in the labor force over this time period. I say all this to say that you have this extreme position for people who are out of work. They still are having a very difficult time finding jobs, and we're seeing a lot of evidence that people who are long-term unemployed are being discriminated against as they try to find new jobs. Employers are looking at them and saying, well, why should I hire you? You've been out of work for a long time. I'm going to hire this person who has a job, or this person just lost their job last month. And I think you see a lot of that, especially among younger people. You know, why hire someone who's been out of college for a year and couldn't find a job when you could hire somebody who just graduated last year or this year, you know? So these are real pressing issues. And I think it is, quite frankly, to me, it seems very cruel and vindictive to make the long-term unemployed pay a very high personal price for this budget deal. And it's not just bad for workers and their families, but it's also bad for those communities that have high long-term unemployment. It's bad for the landlords whose unemployed tenant won't be able to pay the rent. It's bad for homeowners that are still struggling with their mortgages. It's bad for local grocery stores and all the like, because those people don't have money to spend it. So it really is, there's not economic evidence that these benefits are keeping people from jobs. The weight of the evidence is that those jobs, quite frankly, are hard to find and there's not enough available. So by cutting these benefits, we're only sort of shooting ourselves in the foot.
So with this 1.3 million people being made jobless on December the 28th, just after Christmas, and many of them, I don't think have anywhere else to go but into poverty, that's not the end of it, is it? There's going to be another 1.9 million thrown off the unemployment rolls in, mid-2014?
Yes. I mean, the people who are thrown off the long-term unemployment rolls will just continue as the months go on. So this is going to be a real problem for millions of American families. And it's not like there's some sort of, you know, magic jobs fairy that's going to show up and just give them a job just because we've cut off their benefits. If that was the way the world worked, it would be a much happier place for many of the unemployed, but that's quite frankly not what is likely to happen. And so, this is going to create real hardship, and it's a real failure of this Congress to deal with it. But again, they still have a chance. They could come back after their holiday, and they could decide that that this is something that they really think is important, and then they want to get on the ball and do it.
So a lot of people on the conservative side consider themselves religious, and I'm curious to know, over this season, which celebrates the birth of Jesus Christ, who many of the people in Congress consider their spiritual leader, from my recollection of what the prophet Jesus said, he mostly ministered to the poor and was mostly concerned about the poor. So is there any possibility
of a religious component being revived here? Because there is this streak of cruelty that's emerged lately, which I don't understand, where lots of Americans had their food stamp benefits taken away. In the case of one of the congressmen in the House who considers himself religious, Stephen Fincher of Tennessee, he's one of the biggest recipients of farm subsidies from the federal government, meaning from the taxpayer, in the state of Tennessee. And yet he went on the floor and quoted the Bible, saying something to the effect that he who does not work doesn't deserve to be fed. I don't understand that kind of cruel theology. It reminds me of what one of the American revolutionaries, Tom Paine, said, that he who believes in a cruel God is a cruel man.
You know, I'm actually very glad that you brought that up. And, you know, I believe it was today. I think if my memory is serving, that Time magazine just made Pope Francis the Person of the Year, in no small part because he has elevated issues around economics and economic inequality as something that we should all be concerned about, but especially, in his case, people of the Catholic faith. You know, it does seem that kind of kicking a person when they're down doesn't seem very consistent with a lot of things that seem good and right in the world. And it does seem as though we are not actually paying enough attention to making sure that the people that live in our communities, our neighbors and our friends, are actually able to support themselves and their families. And it does seem to me that in a country that does, where you have so many politicians where faith does appear to play such an important part of their life, that kind of ethos is not really, we don't hear enough about that in the American political debate.
Well, it would seem, though, that the time for Pope Francis to weigh in on his fellow Catholic, Paul Ryan, was during the negotiations, because one has to assume that Senator Patty Murray at least tried to get the unemployment extended, which was the position of most of the Democrats, right?
Yes, one does have to assume that. I mean, not being in those meetings, you never know, but that would be my presumption. And yes, it does seem like, you know, Pope Francis did, start talking a lot about inequality and economic exclusion, in November. And, you know, those messages certainly seemed loud and clear to me, that making sure that we are remembering the less fortunate, that we're seeing some of the evils around inequality, and that these are, I think importantly, and I think that one of the things that I found very interesting in the coverage of what the Pope was saying is that these are choices, and quite frankly, these are choices that policymakers in Congress and in the White House are making about that have real effects on people's lives, and how people fare in the economy in no small part determines how they're going to fare in their life. If you deny somebody not only the possibility to get a job because you have an economic recovery that hasn't been weak and that hasn't been strong enough, it's been too weak to create all the jobs for everybody who needs them, then you take away their benefits, then you're taking away people's ability to pay their rent, to put food on the table, to do the things that they want and need to do for their children and their loved ones. So these are very profound, deep and profoundly important moral issues that Congress is talking about when they're talking about budgets.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Heather Bushy, just a question for an economist, which you are. I believe it's Economics 101 that during a recovery, you try to stimulate, you prime the pump, you don't turn off the tap. And yet here we are turning off the tap on food stamps, which are a multiplier, in my understanding, in the economy. And now we're turning off the tap on unemployment benefits, which also, I assume, is also a multiplier. Where's the economic sense in that?
Well, there is no economic sense in it. I mean, we are at a point in our economic recovery where we've made a lot of progress, but we have not, we are not home yet. We have not finished the job. We've not gotten the employment rate back where it needs to be. And yet we have decided that now's the time where we're going to pare back on spending, and we're going to do it by cutting back benefits and programs that affect the most vulnerable, the least among us. And that is both, that's not very nice, but it's also really bad economics. We know that those programs that target dollars towards people who need it most, those people go out and spend it. That unemployed family that's going to lose their benefits on December 28th, the vast majority of them, they're spending every one of those dollars every week of those their benefits on rent and food and things that they need. That's money going into their community. That does have a stronger multiplier effect than almost any other kind of spending. And so that's exactly what you want to see pumped out into the economy. And we have, I mean, my goodness, I'm sitting here looking at my bookshelf. We have piles of economic evidence that shows that that is the right economic policy. So this is enormously frustrating.
Well, but from your point of view in Washington, as a liberal economist, which I assume is a fair description, what is it about your conservative colleagues? Why don't they get it?
You know, if I could answer that question, I feel like we could really figure out a way to convince them. You know, I mean, I think that one key challenge is that too many folks here in Washington believe this sort of knee-jerk, what I now kind of refer to as a knee-jerk, but I guess that sounds a little denigrating, but they believe this idea that the way that the economy grows is that, you know, you have these job creators that are investors, and so what you need to do to create jobs is to make sure that investors have more money, so you give them tax cuts or other kinds of perks so that they'll go out there and create jobs. And we know from a lot of evidence that that is not the most, that has not been the most effective way to create jobs, and that that is not really the way the economy works. Any economist will tell you that the way the economy works, you have to be attentive to what's going on with demand. Do people have enough cold, hard cash in their pockets to go out and buy the stuff that people produce? You have to be very attentive to the skills and the talents and the way that you can really mobilize your population to be the kinds of workers and entrepreneurs that you need to push your economy forward. These are all very different priorities than a very simplistic model that is focused just on, you know, whether or not investors have enough cash today to invest. And I think too often we get stuck in this very narrow mindset about what's going to make the economy grow. That's not just a failed model, but it's a model that causes us to think, and I think many, mostly folks on the other side of the aisle, but certainly folks on the Democratic side as well, causes them to think that what they need to do to create jobs is to, you know, be tough on the poor or to just give tax cuts to the wealthy. And it's a failed model.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Heather Bushy.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Heather Bushy, who's Executive Director and Chief Economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth and a Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. Her research focuses on economic inequality and public policy, specifically employment, social policy, and family economic well-being, and she testifies before Congress often on economic policy issues. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back with Henry Giroux talking about zombie politics and our indentured generation of students.
Got a nightlife off the day job, pushing paper, swinging pendulums. Anything to serve a function or to occupy some time. You gotta earn this living somehow. You're good as dead without a bank account. But it's funny how a lot you felt down in that unemployment line with all that.
And joining us now is Henry Giroux, who's a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University. He's the author of Youth in a Suspect Society, Democracy or Disposability, The University in Change, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex, Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism, and his latest, America's Education Deficit and the War on Youth, Reform Beyond Electoral Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Giroux.
Oh, it's good to be here.
And I've been trying to cover the crisis in education, in particular student debt, which has reached almost a par with household mortgage debt, if not the first biggest debt in the country, certainly the second. And you've described this, or a friend of yours has described this generation, this indentured generation, as a zero generation, zero job, zero hope, zero possibilities, zero employment. Is it as bleak as that?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that what we've lost in talking about young people are two things. We've lost any sense of the relationship that we have or obligation that we have to young people vis-a-vis what was once called the social contract. And so they're no longer an object of long-term investments. They're now actually the object, in many cases, of either oppressive modes of containment, pedagogies of repression, or they're subject to what we call a debt war that really sort of not only steals the future away from them, but it just completely stifles any sense of what we might call the radical imagination. I mean, if any element of our society should harbor the potential for being able to imagine something different, more democratic, more that reeks of hope and generosity and compassion, it's young people. And we're actually eliminating the conditions for many of them that even make that possible.
Well, I've read reports from economists saying that the indenturement of students with student debt and saddling them with debt for life, which, by the way, the Department of Education makes money out of student debt, a considerable amount of money. And recently, the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has basically taken the policing of student loans away from the Department of Education because of their abuse of students. So not only are these students being indentured, the debt collectors from the government, which forbids them from going into bankruptcy, are harassing them.
Well, I've actually read where, and maybe this is the implication, that they're contracting out these kinds of services to debt collection agencies that are actually ruthless,
right,
in their willingness to pursue young people who basically don't have the money to pay back loans that they shouldn't be paying back in the first place. And I think that, you know, what we're going to see in the future, given the kind of casino capitalism that's now at work in the United States and in some other countries, under the name of austerity measures, what we're going to see is the rise of debtor prisons. I mean, that's next. I mean, a lot of these debt collectors now work very closely with attorney generals and law enforcement people and legal people who basically are bringing these kids into court and putting them in jail. I mean, trying to actually imprison them as a result of their defaulting on these debts. I mean, this is just, can you imagine? I mean, we put a generation of young people in jail because they're paying for something that should be free, while these people in Wall Street and the hedge fund managers and the people who have put the country into ruin since 2007 while benefiting off the misery and the suffering of other people actually get celebrated and go free.
Well, I was going to mention what the economists are saying, though, in terms of how this is depressing the economy, because normally before we had this indentured generation, which has just been happening gradually, but it's increased dramatically in the last few decades. Normally, these young people would be consuming. They'd be buying houses and refrigerators and cars instead of paying off their student loans, which is depressing this economy, which, you know, like it or not, unfortunately, 70% of our economy depends upon consumption. So, you know, I recall the old reactionary Henry Ford saying that, you know, you got to pay your workers enough to buy your product. So I don't understand the lack of logic here in terms of this new capitalism that you refer to as casino capitalism. Is it?
No, I think there is a logic, and I think what the logic is, the logic points to a very specific new set of what we might call political social relations, in that power now floats. You know, it's no longer attached to nation states. So what you have is you have this global ruling elite who doesn't really not concerned about political concessions to labor, to students, or to anybody else. And I'm not so sure they're even concerned about consumerism fueling the economy. I mean, these are people who trade in money for money. I mean, this is how they make their money now. I mean, they don't care about investing. They just care about selling off things and, you know, creating paper trails levels of money. And so I don't think that you really have the concern that we've had in the past when the economy was not financialized in the way it is today. These people are ruthless. I mean, they really don't have a major concern about the old Fordist economy where there were political concessions made to workers, where you had to be concerned about the fact that 75% of the society is being driven by consumerism. These new financial elite are really outside in some ways of the boundaries of those considerations. And even if the United States crumbled and failed, they'd move onward. I mean, believe me, there is no longer any allegiance to those kinds of considerations.
But obviously, at the end of the day, you cannot have a viable economy if you're consistently and relentlessly and ruthlessly extracting wealth and not creating wealth.
Well, ask them about that. I guess that's the important question, right?
Right.
I mean, if you want an economy that somehow works, even according to a liberal market logic, then clearly wealth has to go back into the economy. But I must tell you, Ian, everything that I read about this group of hedge fund crooks, financiers, and the financial elite and the bankers, they just seem oblivious to that. I mean, they seem to be concerned not about the long-term future and stability of an economic system, one in which they would greatly benefit. They're really concerned about short-term gains as quick as possible, regardless of the misery, regardless of the suffering, and regardless of the consequences.
Again,
that's why it's called casino capitalism. The house always wins, and everybody else loses.
Again, I'm speaking with Henry Giroux, who is the writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University. He is the author of Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism, and his latest book is America's Education Deficit and the War on Youth, Reform Beyond Electoral Politics. And you were recently on Bill Moyers, Henry, and he really seized on your book, Zombie Politics and the Culture of in the Age of Casino Capitalism. So tell me, what do you mean by zombie politics?
Well, I mean, it's a kind of metaphor that basically speaks to the fact that we now have people who rule the country who love death-dealing institutions. And in many ways, you know, they love, you know, and rarely criticize, you know, bloated military budgets, the rise of the punishing state, the massive amounts of inequality. These are the walking dead. And the metaphor basically has a double meaning. I mean, at one level, it suggests people who are really heavily invested in what I call the organization and production of violence and what we might call realms of social and civil death. That's one. That's the higher register of meaning, metaphorically. The other side of that meaning is that there are a lot of people who are like the Walking Dead, in that their lives are so organized around barely surviving that they barely have the opportunity to enact any sense of critical engagement in agency. They're just getting by. I mean, 45 million people without health insurance, 47 million people on food stamps. I mean, you know the figures better than anyone. And I think that what we increasingly see is we see this zone of social and civil death sort of expanding across the country in ways that make the United States look like really, I mean, a third world country. I mean, a country that is basically mired in massive amounts of poverty and human suffering. But I think the zombie metaphor, where it becomes particularly apt around the question of casino capitalism, is that this is not a politics wedded to life. I mean, it's not a politics wedded to justice. It's not a politics wedded in any way to what we might call the realm of possibility or to the collective imagination. I mean, it really is a politics wedded to social death for most people. And in that sense, I think the zombie metaphor is quite apt. I mean, these are blood-sucking, death-dealing politicians, anti-public intellectuals, lackeys who work in the university, who basically are on the take, you know, who do research for major corporations, even though they know that this research in the end probably ultimately harms people. I mean, there's a whole slew of them out there that have joined that culture. It's a culture that has nothing to do with democracy, and it has everything to do with the most authoritarian fundamentalisms that we can speak of as they begin to emerge in the 21st century.
So why not some pushback here? Why not a revolutionary pushback? Is there a problem with the American left?
No, I mean, it's It's the great question, and it's the most important question. And I think that first there has to be some qualifications. And one qualification is that, look, power is never simply about domination. I mean, there are people pushing back. There are youth people. There are many young people, many youth organizations pushing back. There are people organized around local issues that are pushing back, whether it be the environment, whether it be questions of militarization, whether it be fracking, whether it be the oil line. I mean, we know this. I mean, they don't get the attention. They're not, in a celebrity culture, they're not part of the spectacle. So we don't see this. We know it's happening. The other side of this is there are two problems. One is while the emergence of these groups is very hopeful and speaks to some potential political changes, we really need to link these groups together. This fragmentation that has marked the left for so long, particularly since the end of the 1960s, really represents the death blow of the left. We need major organizations. While the Occupy movement was fine in terms of raising questions about what mattered, inequality and the 1% and all of that, I mean, it sputtered out because it can't produce national organizations, national infrastructures. You need visions matched by strategies, matched by organizational structures. So we need a third party. There's no question about that. The Republican and Democratic parties are simply, you know, two sides of the same coin. They're wedded to neoliberal ideologies. You know, it's the Clinton and Bush party. I mean, that's basically what it is. And I think that thirdly, we have to realize that the economic crisis in the United States has to be matched by a crisis of ideas. And while we're able to recognize the economic crisis, we haven't been able to recognize how important the crisis of ideas is. And that crisis basically speaks to why is it that neoliberalism in particular is able to mobilize the needs, the desires, and the values of people in ways in which they agree to forms of oppression that basically oppress them. You know, where is the left around education? Where is it around questions of consciousness? Where is it around the great struggle over ideas? You know, what does it mean to reclaim democracy, for instance, in the United States, in a way that talks about radical democracy and not just this nonsense that passes for democracy today with a two-party system that's basically bought by the bankers and the lobbyists?
Well, I understand, Henry Giroux, the detrimental effects of identity politics on the left, but I'm broadcasting from the Pacifica Network that's going bankrupt because it's moving away from traditional left-wing politics. And of course, as you know, the media spectrum is entirely dominated by the right and by corporate power and right-wing influence. And this tiny little sliver on the left is extinguishing itself because it's gravitating towards conspiracy and quackery. And people, they think they're on the left, but they're actually, many of them are adherents of this right-wing nutcase, Alex Jones. So what's happening to political literacy in the country?
Oh, no, it's truly a crisis of major proportions. I mean, I think that when we confuse literacy with the kind of idiocy that passes for celebrity culture, then we know they have won. When they can set the agenda for what needs to be talked about and what needs to be taken seriously, when we have to sort of reclaim their language in order to feel that that's the only way that we can be relevant, that's truly a crisis of political literacy. But it's also a crisis of bravery. I mean, it's also a crisis of civic courage. I mean, it seems to me that if the left has anything that it can claim to over the course of the last 200 years, it's a sense of dignity and the willingness to speak out and to talk about issues intelligently in a way that mobilizes people. I mean, some of this is our own fault, as you well know. I mean, it seems to me the most important public intellectuals in the country today are people like you. You know, are people who are on public radio taking real issues, talking about them seriously, but doing it in a language that's accessible, without sacrificing theoretical and political rigor. That's the key. I mean, I think that as soon as we see, you know, political issues migrating to universities in ways in which they get completely caught up in these firewalls of academic jargon, and I'm not talking about the importance of theory, I'm talking about jargon, I'm talking about people who talk to each other, five other people, and believe somehow they're making a contribution, we've lost the notion and the meaning of public intellectual. We no longer know what it means. And yet it seems to me that the university, among other places, along with journalists, may be the only two places left really, in the United States, where public intellectuals have an opportunity to really begin to, in some way, join with social movements, help to shape policy, speak in a language that's accessible, but more importantly, talk about issues that are simply left out of the conversation.
Again, I'm speaking with Henry Giroux, a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University and the author of Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism and his latest book, America's Education Deficit and the War on Youth, Reform Beyond Electoral Politics. When you talk about celebrity culture, because I'm talking to you from across the street from Universal Studios here in Hollywood, which, you know, Hollywood and television basically propagate celebrity culture. They also propagate the culture of violence through gun worshipping. Every poster of every movie has somebody pointing a gun at you. And we also, as a society, we see what this deadly intersection between mental illness and easy access to firearms does on a regular basis with these recurring massacres that we don't seem to be able to do anything about politically. But in terms of celebrity culture, it sort of reminds you of the old Marxian phrase of the opiate of the masses. I was watching television, and you can't escape it, Henry. Since this movie star got killed driving a car too fast, the outpouring of working class people going to this shrine where the car exploded into flames and the press coverage of it, as though these people knew this guy. I mean, there's a real...
I mean, I think that, you know, I hear that, and I think to myself, you know, look, what kind of needs are being mobilized in people in ways that offer the swindle of fulfillment? I mean, what real needs are being activated here, although they end up in this silly, stupid sort of worship of celebrities that they don't even know, and then they're weeping as if, you know, it was their brother or sister that died. I mean, I think that, you know, we live in a culture in which not the real violence, symbolic violence that's being waged by Hollywood, is one that says a couple of things to us. It says, one, we're alone. We're alone. That all problems that matter can only be solved by virtue of your own initiative and sense of individual responsibility. People are completely atomized. We have completely destroyed, for the most part, at least vis-a-vis Hollywood and the major cultural apparatuses, any sense of community. So people are just flocking anywhere where they can have some sense of attachment. Secondly, it seems to me that violence increasingly becomes the only force that is capable of mediating and addressing any kind of problem that we have. The United States is an entirely militarized society. And it's not only militarized in terms of the war machine that we've created that's larger than, you know, the next seven countries combined. It's militarized in terms of its culture. I mean, we've militarized the police. I mean, everywhere we turn, violence is like an electric current. It's like the only place left that can combine with pleasure to offer some sort of sense of intense gratification. That's just one step away from the worst kind of authoritarianism. And thirdly, it seems to me that the question of violence, beyond being symbolic, is a question of political economy. I mean, we have these massive, these massive organizations that have enormous amounts of wealth, that are so invested in these zombie-like machineries of death, that what it speaks to is the need for a revolution in the United States. I mean, you really need a peaceful, civil revolution. I mean, these sources of what we might call, again, the organization of the production of violence, they have to be dismantled. And we can only hope that the conditions increasingly are matched by a raise in collective consciousness and a sense of indignation and a push towards a collective imagination that allow people to be able to understand that instead of celebrity culture, we could have radical democracy. Instead of a joy in violence, we could have a joy in community. You know, instead of a sense of being alone, that there are problems that are systemic, that are beyond our reach, and that we can solve those problems if we change the system.
Well, Henry Giroux, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Henry Giroux, who's a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University. He's the author of Youth in a Suspect Society, Democracy or Disposability, The University of Change, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex, Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism, and his latest book, America's Education Deficit and the War on Youth, Reform Beyond Electoral Politics. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the suspension of aid to the Syrian rebels following the seizure of the Free Syrian Army warehouse full of weapons by Islamists. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Asher Kaufman, who is a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University, Jerusalem. And from 2000 to 2004, he was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace. He headed up its Middle East unit from 2004 to 2005. Asher Kaufman is the author of Reviving Phoenicia, The Search for Identity in Lebanon, A History of Modern Lebanese National Identity. And his forthcoming book is Contested Frontiers, Cartography, Sovereignty, and the Conflict at the Syrian-Lebanon-Israel Tri-Border Region. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asher Kaufman.
Thank you for having me.
And the latest news we have from the war in Syria does not bode well for the Syrian opposition. Yet another example of infighting, but this time the Islamists have seized a number of bases of the Free Syrian Army and have seized warehouses full of weapons, which has prompted both the United States and the United Kingdom to suspend non-lethal aid to the Syrian rebels. I guess it's just going to get worse by the sound of it.
Yes, it is going to get worse. I mean, this conflict has no ending in sight. The opposition is seriously fragmented. We have just seen another sign of it. The Western-backed coalition is turning out to be weaker by the day, and the Islamist elements of the opposition are getting stronger. So, and as we have seen in the past few months, the regime itself is getting a little bit back on its feet. But I don't see any end in sight.
And the Islamists have formed a new Islamic Front, which is a combination of several of leading rebel groups, excluding the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Al-Nusra and Islamic State in Iraq. And they appear to be the ones that seize these weapons right on the Turkish border. They have an estimated 45,000 fighters. What's the role of Turkey here in terms of, we know that the Saudis and the Qataris are backing the Islamists, even though they claim that it's not official state policy, that these are just wealthy individuals in the Gulf and in Saudi Arabia motivated by their Islamic passions to spread Sharia law or whatever the hell they think they're doing. That's their explanation. It doesn't hold water because these are very tightly controlled states. But what is Turkey's position vis-a-vis arming the Islamists?
I mean, the Turks have been very careful in their involvement in the civil war, but I would say that more and more they have found themselves perhaps inevitably being drawn into it, including supporting the Islamist elements of the opposition. They not necessarily speak the exact language as these Islamists, in terms of religious doctrine, but definitely the Turkish government and these Islamists have some common denominators, and you see that in Turkey's willingness to pass arms through its borders to these to the rebels, and Turkey up north has become their most important lifeline in terms of foreign fighters and weapons and other forms of assistance which they get from Turkey. Not officially, but it is done. Still, it is done.
Well, the spokespeople for this new Islamic front who seized these bases from the Free Syrian Army and their warehouses full of weapons, which largely come from the US and the UK, who have suspended non-lethal aid as a result, they're saying that they asked, which I think is a kind of an amusing euphemism, they asked the Free Syrian Army people to leave, and they say that they're our brothers, that we don't want to make them the enemy. But there has been evidence of shootouts between Islamists and the more secular Free Syrian Army.
Yes, there have been cases of actually real combat taking place between these two opposition groups. This time it was done without force, or without armed force at least. They were asked to leave, and because of the imbalance of power between the two, the Free Syrian Army soldiers left their bases there. And they themselves indicated that they see the Islamic Front as their brothers. But we have also to think about what these parties are thinking, not only on the ground, but in terms of the peace talks that who knows if they would take place. But talks are that in Geneva, we'll have in January some kind of a gathering conference with support on organization of the United States and Russia. So everybody is, gearing up towards that possible event and making sure that they have more territory on the ground and more support on the ground, thinking that that would actually improve their bargaining capabilities in that conference should it take place.
Well, that's a real caveat, though, is it should it take place. It does look as if Bashar al-Assad is feeling pretty confident lately. He's taken a main highway into Lebanon. His forces have taken a main highway into Lebanon, and they're moving on the last rebel village between Syria and Lebanon, which, of course, is impacted with enormous refugee problems. And by the way, the refugees, one-third of the population of Syria is displaced now. The refugees in both Lebanon and in Jordan are going to be suffering through an incredibly cold winter front that's moving in. So the misery that's associated with this war is unbelievable.
Yes,
yet the international response, and I know it's been frustrated because the Chinese and the Russians don't want to, are protecting Assad, but still, I recall, early in the war, which has now gone on for 33 months, Hillary Clinton saying that, Assad's going to go. So she was saying he was going to go rhetorically at a time when, if they were to help the secular Free Syrian Army, who were the first people to rise up, well, they weren't even an army when they rose up, they were just citizens rising up. If they would have been helped at that point, there would have been a chance to have fulfilled her rhetoric, or at least made her rhetoric real. Instead of mouthing off, the U.S., gave no real help to the rebellion, and now it's metastasized into this Islamic stew.
It went out of control. I mean, we don't know really what could have happened had they supported the opposition when it just started. Clearly, that opposition may have had the better chance to counter Assad's army. But right now, clearly, it went out of control, and no matter how you look at it, it's we have reached a moment of impasse. This civil war is not going to end anytime soon. That's my analysis. And despite the fact that Bashar al-Assad seems to be recuperating and being able to hold the ground better than a year ago, I don't think we see actually victory. He is still unable to control large parts of his country. the rebels are still strong and willing to fight and die for their cause, and honestly has limited manpower. I mean, if you think about that from the perspective of manpower, he mostly relies on Alawite support with some minor assistance from other groups in Syria. That is a limited human resource for him, as opposed to the opposition that has more human resources to use, to tap from.
Again.
And he relies definitely on foreign foreign support. I mean, without Iran and Russia, with, of course, Hezbollah as a proxy, he would not have been able to stand the ground, his ground. And who knows, maybe this is actually where we can find some space of maneuver with this now new United States American-Iranian engagement over the nuclear plan, with the cooperation between the United States and Russia over Syrian chemical weapons and Geneva II. This may be a place where we might see some change, because at the end of the day, the war would be determined through the outside support of the two parties. I mean, if Syria sees, or if the regime ceases to get assistance from Russia or Iran, or is pushed by these two countries to reach some political deal with the opposition, then we may see some change.
So, again, Asher, it seems, though, that Assad basically, it seems like he can still survive, having written off most of the north of his country. Obviously, losing the oil in the Kurdish area doesn't help. But that seems to be part of the problem here, of why it's going to go on forever, that as long as he can hold on to Damascus and the Alawite area, he seems to be perfectly happy to wait the rebels out. And as you pointed out, they have more resources coming in terms of willing jihadis, whereas his Alawites are being depleted, but they in turn get reinforced by Iran and Hezbollah. So there, I guess, is the stalemate, right?
Yes, this is the stalemate. I mean, somebody has already equated this situation to two boxers, in a ring, trying to beat each other, but both of them are actually, almost wiped out physically. And I think this is what you see now. You see the regime a bit stronger than what it was a few months ago, but you definitely don't see the end of it. The regime cannot claim victory, and I don't think it would ever be able to claim victory under these the conditions as they have developed, in the last 33 months. And obviously, this civil war will end. It will end because, civil wars, they begin, they end, like all other conflicts. But we are in a position now where we don't see the end of it. And there is, no matter how you look at it, we are in a sort of an impasse in terms of our ability as outsiders, Western powers, or even Russia or Iran, to put an end to it. And the two parties, I cannot even say two parties, but the regime and the many parties that fight the regime, are not in the position to sit and negotiate.
So when you say it could go on for a long time, Asher Kaufman, former State Department official P.J. Crowley just said it could go on for a decade. Would you go that far?
Yes. I mean, I always go back to Lebanon. The civil war there lasted 15 years. And there is no reason why we would not think that in Syria it could last that long, maybe even longer. Maybe the country would de facto be cantonized. We cannot. I mean, it's difficult to tell right now. But a prolonged civil war is definitely a possibility, so long as there is outside support for the parties, the war can continue. And that has been the case in Lebanon. It was only when the rivaling parties were tired and did not want to continue the fighting anymore, but when there was support from the outside has stopped being given to them, that the Lebanese civil war ended. And we are not there now in the Syrian case.
Well, we know that there's a possibility of change in Iran and vis-a-vis Iran's relationship with the United States and with the outside world in general. That may change. But what's going to happen with the Turkish role here? Because my understanding is that a lot of Turkish analysts are saying that, you know, that they've really got themselves in more trouble than they bargained for, because, again, there were very optimistic signs from Erdogan, the leader of Turkey, basically saying that, Assad was finished. And that's when also when Hillary Clinton was making similar pronouncements, and that's clearly not happened. My understanding is that the Islamists in the Turkish government are basically saying, well, we got to keep helping these radicals, you know, because actually, where I'm looking for this quote here, they are still in the family, albeit maybe they're black sheeps in the family.
Yes, that's the point I said earlier. I mean, what is funny, or maybe funny is not the right word, but looking at Turkey's foreign policy prior to the eruption of the civil war in Syria, when the Turkish foreign minister famously said that the Turkish foreign policy is zero problems with its neighbors, and that has clearly been thrown away to the garbage bin of history. And what you see is a growing involvement of Turkey into this conflict, and that's inevitable. It's inevitable not only because of the proximity of Turkey to Syria, but also because of the political ambitions of Turkey and the power of Turkey. Being such a big and powerful country, it cannot stay neutral, it cannot stay away from this conflict. It has to maintain its interests, and power here plays a role. If you look around Syria, then out of all the immediate neighbors of Syria, with the exception of Israel, Turkey is by far the strongest and with a very clear ability, more than others, to play an active role in this war as a state. And that, I think, is clearly understood by the Turks themselves. And the Turkish-Kurdish element here is it's not only a matter of the Syrian civil war, but it's a domestic Turkish issue that Erdogan's government has to be aware of and is aware of. There is also an Alawi community in Turkey, a small Alawi community and a very large Alevi community that has some religious affiliation with the Alawites. And that also plays a very important domestic issue for the Turks. So they cannot stay outside of it, and that's the biggest challenge, how to be involved and at the same time trying to avoid the full empowerment of Al-Qaeda-affiliated opposition forces, which are clearly not, this is not in the interest of Turkey.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Asher Kaufman.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Asher Kaufman, who's a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University, Jerusalem. And from 2000 to 2004, he was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace, where he headed up its Middle East unit. He is the author of Reviving Phoenicia, The Search for Identity in Lebanon. And his latest book coming out soon is Contested Frontiers, Cartography, Sovereignty, and the Conflict at the Syrian-Lebanon-Israel Tri-Border Region. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.